Hi, just popping in really quick. This is probably going to be the longest episode I've done. I'm trying to go all the way to the end here because I'm tired of having to edit everything every time. And I want to do new stuff. It's October. I want to get through some stuff, so we're going to go all the way through. It's probably going to be raw and unedited, so I'm sorry in advance if that's not what you like. If you like things smooth and streamlined, stick around for the next episode, maybe when I feel like doing that again. But for now, it's just me, and I don't want to do that. So here we go, all the way to the end. Strap in. It's going to be a long one. Chapter 69. Mr. Bulstrode was still seated in his manager's room at the bank, about 3 o'clock of the same day on which he had received Lydgate there, when the clerk entered to say that his horse was waiting, and also that Mr. Garth was outside and begged to speak with him. "By all means," said Bulstrode, and Caleb entered. "Pray, sit down, Mr. Garth," continued the banker, in his suavest tone. "I'm glad that you arrived just in time to find me here. I know you count your minutes." "Oh," said Caleb, gently, with a slow swing of his head on one side, as he seated himself and laid his hat on the floor. He looked at the ground, leaning forward and letting his long fingers droop between his legs, while each finger moved in succession, as if it were sharing some thought which filled his large, quiet brow. Mr. Bulstrode, like everyone else who knew Caleb, was used to his slowness in beginning to speak on any topic which he felt to be important, and rather expected that he was about to recur to the buying of some houses in Blind Men's Court for the sake of pulling them down, as a sacrifice of property which would be well repaid by the influx of air and light on that spot. It was by propositions of this kind that Caleb was sometimes troublesome to his employers, but he had usually found Bulstrode ready to meet him in projects of improvement, and they had got on well together. When he spoke again, however, it was to say, in rather a subdued voice, "I've just come away from Stone Court, Mr. Bulstrode." "You found nothing wrong there, I hope," said the banker. "I was there myself yesterday. Abel has done well with the lambs this year." "Why, yes," said Caleb, looking up gravely. "There is something wrong. A stranger who is very ill, I think. He wants a doctor, and I came to tell you of that. His name is Raffles." He saw the shock of his words passing through Bulstrode's frame. On this subject, the banker had thought that his fears were too constantly on the watch to be taken by surprise, but he had been mistaken. "Poor wretch," he said in a compassionate tone, though his lips trembled a little. "Do you know how he came there?" "I took him myself," said Caleb quietly. "Took him up in my gig. He had got down from the coach and was walking a little beyond the turning from the toll house, and I overtook him. He remembered seeing me with you once before at Stone Court, and he asked me to take him on. I saw he was ill. It seemed to me the right thing to do, to carry him under shelter. And now I think you should lose no time in getting advice for him." Caleb took up his hat from the floor as he ended, and rose slowly from his seat. "Certainly," said Bulstrode, whose mind was very active at this moment. "Perhaps you will yourself oblige me, Mr. Garth, by calling at Mr. Lydgate's as you pass. Or stay, he may at this hour probably be at the hospital. I will first send my man on the horse there with a note this instant, and then I will myself ride to Stone Court." Bulstrode quickly wrote a note, and went out himself to give the commission to his man. When he returned, Caleb was standing as before, with one hand on the back of the chair, holding his hat with the other. In Bulstrode's mind, the dominant thought was, perhaps Raffle only spoke to Garth of his illness. Garth may wonder, as he must have done before, at this disreputable fellow's claiming intimacy with me, but he will know nothing, and he's friendly to me. I can be of use to him. He longed for some confirmation of this hopeful conjecture, but to have asked any question as to what Raffles had said or done would have been to betray fear. "I am exceedingly obliged to you, Mr. Garth," he said, in his usual tone of politeness. "My servant will be back in a few minutes, and I shall then go myself to see what can be done for this unfortunate man. Perhaps you had some other business with me? If so, pray be seated." "Thank you," said Caleb, making a slight gesture with his right hand to waive the invitation. I wish to say, Mr. Bulstrode, that I must request you to put your business into some other hands than mine. I am obliged to you for your handsome way of meeting me, about the letting of Stone Court and all other business, but I must give it up. A sharp certainty entered like a stab into Bulstrode's soul. This is sudden, Mr. Garth, was all he could say at first. It is, said Caleb, but it is quite fixed. I must give it up. He spoke with the firmness which was very gentle, and yet he could see that Bulstrode seemed to cower under that gentleness, his face looking dried and his eyes swerving away from the glance which rested on him. Caleb felt a deep pity for him, but he could have used no pretexts to account for his resolve, even if they would have been of any use. "You've been led to this, I apprehend, by some slanders concerning me uttered by that unhappy creature," said Bulstrode, anxious now to know the utmost. "That is true. I can't deny that I act upon what I heard from him." "You are a conscientious man, Mr. Garth, a man, I trust, who feels himself accountable to God. You would not wish to injure me by being too ready to believe a slander," said Bulstrode, casting about for pleas that might be adapted to his hearer's mind. "That is a poor reason for giving up a connection which I think I may say will be mutually beneficial." "I would injure no man if I could help it," said Caleb, "even if I thought God winked at it. I hope I should have a feeling for my fellow creature. But, sir, I'm obliged to believe that this Raffles has told me the truth, and I can't be happy in working with you or profiting by you. It hurts my mind. I must beg you to seek another agent." "Very well, Mr. Garth, but I must at least claim to know the worst that he's told you. I must know what is the foul speech that I'm liable to be the victim of," said Bulstrode, a certain amount of anger beginning to mingle with his humiliation before this quiet man who renounced his benefits. "That's needless," said Caleb, waving his hand, bowing his head slightly, and not swerving from the tone which had in it the merciful intention to spare this pitiable man. "What he has said to me will never pass from my lips, unless something now unknown forces it from me. If you led a harmful life for gain and kept others out of their rights by deceit, to get the more for yourself, I dare say you repent. You would like to go back, and can't. That must be a bitter thing." Caleb paused a moment and shook his head. "It is not for me to make your life harder to you." "But you do. You do make it harder to me," said Bulstrode, constrained into a genuine, pleading cry. "You make it harder to me by turning your back on me." "That I'm forced to do," said Caleb, still more gently, lifting up his hand. "I'm sorry. I don't judge you and say, 'He's wicked, and I am righteous.' God forbid. I don't know everything. A man may do wrong, and his will may rise clear out of it, though he can't get his life clear. That's a bad punishment. If it is so with you, well, I'm very sorry for you. But I have that feeling inside me that I can't go on working with you. That's all, Mr. Bulstrode. Everything else is buried, so far as my will goes, and I wish you good day." "One moment, Mr. Garth," said Bulstrode hurriedly. "I may trust, then, to your solemn assurance that you will not repeat either to man or woman what, even if it have any degree of truth in it, is yet a malicious representation?" Caleb's wrath was stirred, and he said indignantly, "Why should I have said it if I didn't mean it? I am in no fear of you. Such tales as that will never tempt my tongue. Excuse me, I'm agitated. I am the victim of this abandoned man." "Stop a bit. You've got to consider whether you didn't help to make him worse when you profited by his vices." "You are wronging me by too readily believing him," said Bulstrode, oppressed as by a nightmare, with the inability to deny flatly what Raffles might have said, and yet feeling it an escape that Caleb had not so stated it to him as to ask for that flat denial. "No," said Caleb, lifting his head deprecatingly. "I'm ready to believe better, when better is proved. I rob you of no good chance. As to speaking, I hold it a crime to expose a man's sin unless I'm clear it must be done to save the innocent. That is my way of thinking, Mr. Bulstrode. In what I say, I've no need to swear. I wish you good day. Some hours later, when he was at home, Caleb said to his wife, incidentally, that he had had some little differences with Bulstrode, and that in consequence he had given up all notion of taking Stone Court, and indeed had resigned doing further business for him. He was disposed to interfere too much, was he? Said Mrs. Garth, imagining that her husband had been touched on his sensitive point, and not been allowed to do what he thought right as to materials and modes of work. Oh, said Caleb, bowing his head and waving his hand gravely, and Mrs. Garth knew that this was a sign of his not intending to speak further on the subject. As for Bulstrode, he had almost immediately mounted his horse and set off for Stone Court, being anxious to arrive there before Lydgate. His mind was crowded with images and conjectures, which were a language to his hopes and fears, just as we hear tones from the vibrations which shake our whole system. The deep humiliation with which he had winced under Caleb Garth's knowledge of his past and rejection of his patronage alternated with and almost gave way to the sense of safety in the fact that Garth and no other had been the man to whom Raffles had spoken. It seemed to him a sort of earnest that Providence intended his rescue from worse consequences, the way being thus left open for the hope of secrecy. That Raffles should be afflicted with illness, that he should have been led to Stone Court rather than elsewhere? Bulstrode's heart fluttered at the vision of probabilities which these events conjured up. If it should turn out that he was freed from all danger of disgrace, if he could breathe in perfect liberty, his life should be more consecrated than it ever had been before. He mentally lifted up this vow as if it would urge the result he longed for. He tried to believe in the potency of that prayerful resolution, its potency to determine death. He knew that he ought to say, "Thy will be done," and he said it often, but the intense desire remained that the will of God might be the death of that hated man. Yet when he arrived at Stone Court, he could not see the change in Raffles without a shock. But for his pallor and feebleness, Bulstrode would have called the change in him entirely mental. Instead of his loud, tormenting mood, he showed an intense, vague terror, and seemed to deprecate Bulstrode's anger, because the money was all gone. He had been robbed. It had half of it been taken from him. He had only come here because he was ill, and somebody was hunting him. Somebody was after him. He had told nobody anything. He had kept his mouth shut. Bulstrode, not knowing the significance of these symptoms, interpreted this new nervous susceptibility into a means of alarming Raffles into true confessions, and taxed him with falsehood in saying that he had not told anything, since he had just told the man who took him up in his gig and brought him to Stone Court. Raffles denied this with solemn adjurations, the fact being that the links of consciousness were interrupted in him, and that his minute, terror-stricken narrative to Caleb Garth had been delivered under a set of visionary impulses, which had dropped back into darkness. Bulstrode's heart sank again at this sign that he could get no grasp over the wretched man's mind, and that no word of Raffles could be trusted as to the fact which he most wanted to know, namely, whether or not he had really kept silence to everyone in the neighborhood except Caleb Garth. The housekeeper had told him without the least constraint of manner that since Mr. Garth left, Raffles had asked her for beer, and after that had not spoken, seeming very ill. On that side it might be concluded that there had been no betrayal. Mrs. Abel thought, like the servants at the Shrubs, that the strange man belonged to the unpleasant kin who are among the troubles of the rich. She had at first referred the kinship to Mr. Rigg, and where there was property left, the buzzing presence of such large blue bottles seemed natural enough. How could he be kin to Bulstrode as well was not so clear, but Mrs. Abel agreed with her husband that there was no knowing, a proposition which had a great deal of mental food for her, so that she shook her head over it without further speculation. In less than an hour, Lydgate arrived. Bulstrode met him outside the wainscoted parlor, where Raffles was, and said, "I've called you in, Mr. Lydgate, to an unfortunate man who was once in my employment many years ago. Afterwards he was sent to America, and returned, I fear, to an idle, dissolute life. Being destitute, he has a claim on me. He was slightly connected with Rigg, the former owner of this place, and in consequence found his way here. I believe he is seriously ill. Apparently his mind is affected. I feel bound to do the utmost for him." Lydgate, who had the remembrance of his last conversation with Bulstrode strongly upon him, was not disposed to say an unnecessary word to him, and bowed slightly in answer to this account. But just before entering the room, he turned automatically and said, "What is his name?" To know names being as much a part of the medical man's accomplishment as part of the practical politician's. "Raffles. John Raffles," said Bulstrode, who hoped that whatever became of Raffles, Lydgate would never know any more of him. When he had thoroughly examined and considered the patient, Lydgate ordered that he should go to bed and be kept there in as complete quiet as possible, and then went with Bulstrode into another room. "It is a serious case, I apprehend," said the banker, before Lydgate began to speak. "No, and yes," said Lydgate, half dubiously. "It is difficult to decide as to the possible effect of long-standing complications, but the man has a robust constitution to begin with. I should not expect this attack to be fatal, though of course the system is in a ticklish state. He should be well watched and attended to." "I will remain here myself," said Bulstrode. "Mrs. Abel and her husband are inexperienced. I can easily remain here for the night if you will oblige me by taking a note for Mrs. Bulstrode." "I should think that is hardly necessary," said Lydgate. "He seems tame and terrified enough. He might become more unmanageable." "But there is a man here, is there not?" "I have more than once stayed here a few nights for the sake of seclusion," said Bulstrode indifferently. "I'm quite disposed to do so now. Mrs. Abel and her husband can relieve or aid me if necessary." "Very well, then I need give my directions only to you," said Lydgate, not feeling surprised at a little peculiarity in Bulstrode. "You think, then, that the case is hopeful?" said Bulstrode, when Lydgate had ended giving his orders. "Until there turn out to be further complications, such as I have not at present detected, yes," said Lydgate. "He may pass on to a worse stage, but I should not wonder if he got better in a few days by adhering to the treatment I have prescribed. There must be firmness. Remember, if he calls for liquor of any sort, not to give them to him. In my opinion, men in his condition are oftener killed by treatment than by the disease. Still, new symptoms may arise. I shall come again tomorrow morning." After waiting for the note to be carried to Mrs. Bulstrode, Lydgate rode away, forming no conjectures, in the first instance, about the history of Raffles, but rehearsing the whole argument, which had lately been much stirred by the publication of Dr. Ware's abundant experience in America, as to the right way of treating cases of alcoholic poisoning such as this. Lydgate, when abroad, had already been interested in this question. He was strongly convinced against the prevalent practice of allowing alcohol and persistently administering large doses of opium, and he had repeatedly acted on this conviction with a favorable result. "The man is in a diseased state," he thought, "but there's a good deal of wear in him still. I suppose he's an object of charity to Bulstrode. It is curious what patches of hardness and tenderness lie side by side in men's dispositions. Bulstrode seems the most unsympathetic fellow I ever saw about some people, and yet he has taken no end of trouble and spent a great deal of money on benevolent objects. I suppose he has some test by which he finds out whom heaven cares for. He's made up his mind that it doesn't care for me." This streak of bitterness came from a plenteous source, and kept widening in the current of his thought as he neared Lowick Gate. He had not been there since his first interview with Bulstrode in the morning, having been found at the hospital by the banker's messenger, and for the first time he was returning to his home without the vision of any expedient in the background which left him a hope of raising money enough to deliver him from the coming destitution of everything which made his married life tolerable. Everything which saved him and Rosamond from that bare isolation in which they would be forced to recognize how little of a comfort they could be to each other. It is more bearable to do without tenderness for himself than to see that his own tenderness could make no amends for the lack of other things to her. The sufferings of his own pride from humiliations past and to come were keen enough, yet they were hardly distinguishable to himself from that more acute pain which dominated them. The pain of foreseeing that Rosamond would come to regard him chiefly as the cause of disappointment and unhappiness to her. He had never liked the makeshifts of poverty, and they had never before entered into his prospects for himself. But he was beginning now to imagine how two creatures who loved each other and had a stock of thoughts in common might laugh over their shabby furniture and their calculations how far they could afford butter and eggs. But the glimpse of that poetry seemed as far off from him as the carelessness of the Golden Age. In poor Rosamond's mind, there was not room enough for luxuries to look small in. He got down from his horse in a very sad mood and went into the house, not expecting to be cheered except by his dinner, and reflecting that before the evening closed it would be wise to tell Rosamond of his application to Bulstrode and its failure. It would be well not to lose time in preparing her for the worst. But his dinner waited long for him before he was able to eat it, for on entering he found that Dover's agent had already put a man in the house, and when he asked where Mrs. Lydgate was, he was told that she was in her bedroom. He went up and found her stretched on the bed, pale and silent, without an answer even in her face to any word or look of his. He sat down by the bed and, leaning over her, said with an almost cry of prayer, "Forgive me for this misery, my poor Rosamond. Let us only love one another." She looked at him silently, still with the blank despair on her face, but then the tears began to fill her blue eyes and her lip trembled. The strong man had been too much to bear that day. He let his head fall beside hers and sobbed. He did not hinder her from going to her father early in the morning. It seemed now that he ought not to hinder her from doing as she pleased. And half an hour after she came back and said that Papa and Mama wished her to go and stay with them while things were in this miserable state. Papa said he could do nothing about the debt. If he paid this, there would be half a dozen more. She had better come back home again till Lydgate had got a comfortable home for her.
"Do you object, Tertius?"
"Do as you like," said Lydgate, "but things are not coming to a crisis immediately. There is no hurry." "I should not go till tomorrow," said Rosamond. "I shall want to pack my clothes." "Oh, I would wait a little longer than tomorrow. There's no knowing what may happen," said Lydgate with bitter irony. "I may get my neck broken, and that may make things easier to you." It was Lydgate's misfortune, and Rosamond's too, that his tenderness towards her, which was both an emotional prompting and a well-considered resolve, was inevitably interrupted by these outbursts of indignation, either ironical or remonstrant. She thought them totally unwarranted, and the repulsion which this exceptional severity excited in her was in danger of making the more persistent tenderness unacceptable. "I see you do not wish me to go," she said with chill mildness. "Why can you not say so without that kind of violence? I shall stay until you request me to do otherwise." Lydgate said no more, but went out on his rounds. He felt bruised and shattered, and there was a dark line under his eyes which Rosamond had not seen before. She could not bear to look at him. Tertius had a way of taking things which made them a great deal worse for her. Chapter 70. Bulstrode's first object after Lydgate had left Stone Court was to examine Raffles' pockets, which he imagined were sure to carry signs in the shape of hotel bills of the places he had stopped in, if he had not told the truth in saying that he had come straight from Liverpool because he was ill and had no money. There were various bills crammed into his pocketbook, but none of a later date than Christmas at any other place, except one, which bore date that morning. This was crumpled up with a handbill about a horse fare in one of his tail pockets, and represented the cost of 3 days' stay at an inn in Bilkley, where the fair was held, a town at least 40 miles from Middlemarch. The bill was heavy, and since Raffles had no luggage with him, it seemed probable that he had left his portmanteau behind in payment, in order to save money for his travelling fare, for his purse was empty, and he had only a couple of sixpences and some loose pence in his pockets. Bulstrode gathered a sense of safety from these indications that Raffles had really kept at a distance from Middlemarch since his memorable visit at Christmas. At a distance, and among people who were strangers to Bulstrode, what satisfaction could there be to Raffles' tormenting, self-magnifying vein in telling old scandalous stories about a Middlemarch banker, and what harm if he did talk? The chief point now was to keep watch over him as long as there was any danger of that intelligible raving, that unaccountable impulse to tell, which seemed to have acted towards Caleb Garth, and Bulstrode felt much anxiety lest some such impulse should come over him at the sight of Lydgate. He sat up alone with him through the night, only ordering the housekeeper to lie down in her clothes so as to be ready when he called her, alleging his own indisposition to sleep and his anxiety to carry out the doctor's orders. He did carry them out faithfully, although Raffles was incessantly asking for brandy and declaring that he was sinking away, that the earth was sinking away from under him. He was restless and sleepless, but still quailing and manageable. On the offer of the food ordered by Lydgate, which he refused, and the denial of other things which he demanded, he seemed to concentrate all his terror on Bulstrode, imploringly deprecating his anger, his revenge on him by starvation, and declaring with strong oaths that he had never told any mortal a word against him. Even this Bulstrode felt that he would not have liked Lydgate to hear, but a more alarming sign of fitful alternation in his delirium was that in the morning twilight Raffles suddenly seemed to imagine a doctor present, addressing him and declaring that Bulstrode wanted to starve him to death out of revenge for telling, when he never had told. Bulstrode's native imperiousness and strength of determination served him well. This delicate-looking man, himself nervously perturbed, found the needed stimulus in his strenuous circumstances, and through that difficult night and morning, while he had the air of an animated corpse returned to movement without warmth, holding the mastery by its chill impassibility, his mind was intensely at work, thinking of what he had to guard against and what would win him security. Whatever prayers he might lift up, whatever statements he might inwardly make of this man's wretched spiritual condition, and the duty he himself was under to submit to the punishment divinely appointed for him, rather than to wish for evil to another. Through all this effort to condense words into a solid mental state, there pierced and spread with irresistible vividness the images of the events he desired, and in the train of those images came their apology. He could not but see the death of Raffles, and see in it his own deliverance. What was the removal of this wretched creature? He was impenitent. But were not public criminals impenitent? Yet the law decided on their fate. Should Providence in this case award death? There was no sin in contemplating death as a desirable issue, if he kept his hands from hastening it, if he scrupulously did what was prescribed. Even here there might be a mistake. Human prescriptions were fallible things. Lydgate had said that treatment had hastened death. Why not his own method of treatment? But of course intention was everything in the question of right and wrong. And Bulstrode set himself to keep his intention separate from his desire. He inwardly declared that he intended to obey orders. Why should he have got into any argument about the validity of these orders? It was only the common trick of desire, which avails itself of any irrelevant skepticism, finding larger room for itself in all uncertainty of effects, in every obscurity that looks like the absence of law. Still, he did obey the orders. His anxieties continually glanced towards Lydgate, and his remembrance of what had taken place between them the morning before was accompanied with sensibilities which had not been roused at all during the actual scene. He had then cared but little about Lydgate's painful impressions with regard to the suggested change in the hospital, or about the disposition towards himself which what he held to be his justifiable refusal of a rather exorbitant request might call forth. He recurred to the scene now with a perception that he had probably made Lydgate his enemy, and with an awakened desire to propitiate him, or rather to create in him a strong sense of personal obligation. He regretted that he had not at once made even an unreasonable money sacrifice, for in case of unpleasant suspicions, or even knowledge gathered from the raving of Raffles, Bulstrode would have felt that he had a defense in Lydgate's mind by having conferred him a momentous benefit on him, but the regret had perhaps come too late. Strange, piteous conflict in the soul of this unhappy man, who had longed for years to be better than he was, who had taken his selfish passions into discipline and clad them in severe robes, so that he had walked with them as a devout choir, till now that a terror had risen among them, and they could chant no longer, but threw out their common cries for safety. It was nearly the middle of the day before Lydgate arrived. He had meant to come earlier, but had been detained, he said, and his shattered looks were noticed by Bulstrode. but he immediately threw himself into the consideration of the patient and inquired strictly into all that had occurred. Raffles was worse, would hardly take any food, was persistently wakeful and restlessly raving, but still not violent. Contrary to Bulstrode's alarmed expectation, he took little notice of Lydgate's presence and continued to talk or murmur incoherently. "What do you think of him?" said Bulstrode in private. "The symptoms are worse."
"You are less hopeful?"
"No, I still think he may come round. Are you going to stay here yourself?" said Lydgate, looking at Bulstrode with an abrupt question which made him uneasy, though in reality it was not due to any suspicious conjecture.
"Yes, I think so," said Bulstrode, governing himself and speaking with deliberation. "Mrs. Bulstrode is advised of the reasons which detain me. Mrs. Abel and her husband are not experienced enough to be left quite alone, and this kind of responsibility is scarcely included in their service of me. You have some fresh instructions, I presume?"
The chief new instruction that Lydgate had to give was on the administration of extremely moderate doses of opium, in case of the sleeplessness continuing after several hours. He had taken the precaution of bringing opium in his pocket, and he gave minute directions to Bulstrode as to the doses, and the point at which they should cease. He insisted on the risk of not ceasing, and repeated his order that no alcohol should be given. "From what I see of the case," he ended, "narcotism is the only thing I should be more afraid of. He may wear through even without much food. There's a good deal of strength in him."
"You look ill yourself, Mr. Lydgate. A most unusual, I may say unprecedented thing in my knowledge of you," said Bulstrode, showing a solicitude as unlike his indifference the day before, as his present recklessness about his own fatigue was unlike his habitual self-cherishing anxiety. "I fear you are harassed."
"Yes, I am," said Lydgate, brusquely, holding his hat and ready to go.
"Something new, I fear," said Bulstrode inquiringly. "Pray be seated."
"No, thank you," said Lydgate with some hauteur. "I mentioned to you yesterday what was the state of my affairs. There is nothing to add, except that the execution has since then been actually put into my house. One can tell a good deal of trouble in a short sentence. I will say good morning."
"Stay, Mr. Lydgate, stay," said Bulstrode.
"I've been reconsidering this subject. I was yesterday taken by surprise and saw it superficially. Mrs. Bulstrode is anxious for her niece, and I myself should grieve at a calamitous change in your position. Claims on me are numerous, but on reconsideration, I esteem it right that I should incur a small sacrifice rather than leave you unaided. You said, I think, that £1,000 would suffice entirely to free you from your burthens and enable you to recover a firm stand?"
"Yes," said Lydgate, a great leap of joy within him surmounting every other feeling. "That would pay all my debts and leave me a little on hand. I could set about economizing in our way of living, and by my practice might look up."
"If you will wait a moment, Mr. Lydgate, I will draw a check to that amount. I'm aware that help, to be effectual in these cases, should be thorough." While Bulstrode wrote, Lydgate turned to the window, thinking of his home, thinking of his life with its good start saved from frustration, its good purposes still unbroken. "You could give me a note of hand for this, Mr. Lydgate," said the banker, advancing towards him with the check, "and by, I hope, you may be in circumstances gradually to repay me. Meanwhile, I have pleasure in thinking that you will be released from further difficulty."
"I am deeply obliged to you," said Lydgate. "You have restored to me the prospect of working with some happiness and some chance of good."
It appeared to him a very natural movement in Bulstrode that he should have reconsidered his refusal. It corresponded with the more munificent side of his character. But as he put his hack into a canter, that he might get the sooner home, and tell the good news to Rosamond, and get cash at the bank to pay over to Dover's agent, there crossed his mind, with a very unpleasant impression, as from a dark-winged flight of evil augury across his vision, the thought of that contrast in himself which a few months had brought, that he should be overjoyed at being under a strong personal obligation, that he should be overjoyed at getting money for himself from Bulstrode. The banker felt that he had done something to nullify one case of uneasiness, and yet he was scarcely the easier. He did not measure the quantity of diseased motive which had made him wish for Lydgate's goodwill, but the quantity was nonetheless actively there, like an irritating agent in his blood. A man vows, and yet will not cast away the means of breaking his vow.
Is it that he distinctly means to break it? Not at all, but the desires which tend to break it are at work in him dimly, and make their way into his imagination, and relax his muscles in the very moments when he is telling himself over again the reasons for his vow. Raffles recovering quickly, returning to the free use of his odious powers. How could Bulstrode wish for that? Raffles dead was the image that brought release, and indirectly he prayed for that way of release, beseeching that, if it were possible, the rest of his days here below might be freed from the threat of an ignominy which would break him utterly as an instrument of God's service. Lydgate's opinion was not on the side of promise that this prayer would be fulfilled, and as the day advanced, Bulstrode felt himself getting irritated at the persistent life in this man, whom he would fain have seen sinking into the silence of death. Imperious will stirred murderous impulses towards this brute life, over which will, by itself, had no power. He said inwardly that he was getting too much worn. He would not sit up with the patient tonight, but leave him to Mrs. Abel, who, if necessary, could call her husband. At 6 o'clock, Raffles, having only had fitful, perturbed snatches of sleep, from which he waked with fresh restlessness and perpetual cries that he was sinking away, Bulstrode began to administer the opium according to Lydgate's directions. At the end of half an hour or more, he called Mrs. Abel and told her that he found himself unfit for further watching. He must now consign the patient to her care, and he proceeded to repeat to her Lydgate's directions as to the quantity of each dose. Mrs. Abel had not before known anything of Lydgate's prescriptions. She had simply prepared and brought whatever Bulstrode ordered, and had done what he pointed out to her. She began now to ask what else she should do besides administering the opium. "Nothing at present, except the offer of the soup or the soda water. You can come to me for further directions. Unless there is any important change, I shall not come into the room again tonight. You will ask your husband for help if necessary. I must go to bed early." "You have much need, sir, I'm sure," said Mrs. Abel, "and to take something more strengthening than what you've done." Bulstrode went away now without anxiety as to what Raffles might say in his raving, which had taken on a muttering incoherence not likely to create any dangerous belief. At any rate, he must risk this. He went down into the wainscoted parlour first, and began to consider whether he would not have his horse saddled and go home by the moonlight, and give up caring for earthly consequences. Then he wished that he had begged Lydgate to come again that evening. Perhaps he might deliver a different opinion and think that Raffles was getting into a less hopeful state. Should he send for Lydgate? If Raffles were really getting worse and slowly dying, Bulstrode felt that he could go to bed and sleep in gratitude to Providence. But was he worse? Lydgate might come and simply say that he was going on as he expected, and predict that he would by and by fall into a good sleep and get well. What was the use of sending for him? Bulstrode shrank from that result. No ideas or opinions could hinder him from seeing the one probability to be that Raffles recovered would be just the same man as before, with his strength as a tormentor renewed, obliging him to drag away his wife to spend her years apart from her friends and native place, carrying an alienating suspicion against him in her heart. He had sat an hour and a half in this conflict by the firelight only, when a sudden thought made him rise and light the bed candle, which he had brought down with him. The thought was that he had not told Mrs. Abel when the doses of opium must cease. He took hold of the candlestick, but stood motionless for a long time. She might already have given him more than Lydgate had prescribed, but it was excusable in him that he should forget part of an order in his present wearied condition. He walked upstairs, candle in hand, not knowing whether he should straightway enter his own room and go to bed, or turn to the patient's room and rectify his omission. He paused in the passage, with his face turned towards Raffles' room, and he could hear him moaning and murmuring. He was not asleep then. Who could know that Lydgate's prescription would not be better disobeyed than followed, since there was still no sleep? He turned into his own room. Before he had quite undressed, Mrs. Abel rapped at the door. He opened it an inch, so that he could hear her speak low. "If you please, sir, should I have no brandy nor nothing to give the poor creature? He feels sinking away, and nothing else will he swallow, and but little strength in it if he did, only the opium, and he says more and more he's sinking down through the earth." To her surprise, Mr. Bulstrode did not answer. A struggle was going on within him. I think he must die for want of support if he goes on in that way. When I nursed my poor master, Mr. Robison, I had to give him port wine and brandy constant, and a big glass at a time, added Mrs. Abel, with a touch of remonstrance in her tone. But again, Mr. Bulstrode did not answer immediately, and she continued, It's not a time to spare when people are at death's door, nor would you wish it, sir, I'm sure, else I should give him our own bottle of rum as we keep by us, but a sitter up so as you've been, and doing everything as laid in your power. Here a key was thrust through the inch of the doorway, and Mr. Bulstrode said huskily, That is the key of the wine cooler. You will find plenty of brandy there. Early in the morning, about 6, Mr. Bulstrode rose and spent some time in prayer. Does anyone suppose that private prayer is necessarily candid, necessarily goes to the roots of action? Private prayer is inaudible speech, and speech is representative. Who can represent himself just as he is, even in his own reflections? Bulstrode had not yet unraveled in his thought the confused promptings of the last 24 hours. He listened in the passage and could hear hard, stertorous breathing. Then he walked out in the garden and looked at the early rime on the grass and fresh spring leaves. When he re-entered the house, he felt startled at the sight of Mrs. Abel. How is your patient? Asleep, I think? He said, with an attempt at cheerfulness in his tone. He's gone very deep, sir, said Mrs. Abel. He went off gradual between 3 and 4 o'clock. Would you please to go and look at him? I thought it no harm to leave him. My man's gone afield, and the little girl's seeing to the kettles. Bulstrode went up. At a glance, he knew Raffles was not in the sleep which brings revival, but in the sleep which streams deeper and deeper into the gulf of death. He looked round the room and saw a bottle with some brandy in it and the almost empty opium phial. He put the phial out of sight and carried the brandy bottle downstairs with him, locking it again in the wine cooler. While breakfasting, he considered whether he should ride to Middlemarch at once or wait for Lydgate's arrival. He decided to wait, and told Mrs. Abel that she might go about her work. He could watch in the bedchamber. As he sat there and beheld the enemy of his peace going irrevocably into silence, he felt more at rest than he had done for many months. His conscience was soothed by the enfolding wing of secrecy, which seemed just then like an angel sent down for his relief. He drew out his pocketbook to review various memoranda there as to the arrangements he had projected and partly carried out in the prospect of quitting Middlemarch, and considered how far he would let them stand or recall them, now that his absence would be brief. Some economies which he felt desirable might still find a suitable occasion in his temporary withdrawal from management, and he hoped still that Mrs. Casaubon would take a large share in the expenses of the hospital. In that way the moments passed, until a change in the stertorous breathing was marked enough to draw his attention wholly to the bed, and forced him to think of the departing life, which had once been subservient to his own, which he had once been glad to find base enough for him to act on as he would. It was his gladness, then, which impelled him now to be glad that the life was at an end. And who could say that the death of Raffles had been hastened? Who knew what would have saved him? Lydgate arrived at 10:30, in time to witness the final pause of the breath. When he entered the room, Bulstrode observed a sudden expression in his face, which was not so much surprise as a recognition that he had not judged correctly. He stood by the bed in silence for some time, with his eyes turned on the dying man, but with that subdued activity of expression which showed that he was carrying on an inward debate. "When did this change begin?" said he, looking at Bulstrode. "I did not watch by him last night," said Bulstrode. "I was overworn, and left him with under Mrs. Abel's care. She said that he sank into sleep between 3 and 4 o'clock. When I came in before 8, he was nearly in this condition." Lydgate did not ask another question, but watched in silence until he said, "It's all over." This morning, Lydgate was in a state of recovered hope and freedom. He had set out on his work with all his old animation, and felt himself strong enough to bear all the deficiencies of his married life, and he was conscious that Bulstrode had been a benefactor to him, but he was uneasy about this case. He had not expected it to terminate as it had done, yet he hardly knew how to put a question on the subject of Bulstrode without appearing to insult him, and if he examined the housekeeper, why, the man was dead. There seemed to be no use in implying that somebody's ignorance or imprudence had killed him. And after all, he himself might be wrong. He and Bulstrode rode back to Middlemarch together, talking of many things, chiefly cholera and the chances of the Reform Bill in the House of Lords, and the firm resolve of the political unions. Nothing was said about Raffles, except that Bulstrode mentioned the necessity of having a grave for him in Lowick Churchyard, and observed that, so far as he knew, the poor man had no connections, except Rigg, whom he had stated to be unfriendly towards him. On returning home, Lydgate had a visit from Mr. Fairbrother. The vicar had not been in the town the day before, but the news that there was an execution in Lydgate's house had got to Lowick by the evening, having been carried by Mr. Spicer, shoemaker and parish clerk, who had it from his brother, the respectable bale-hanger in Lowick Gate. Since that evening when Lydgate had come down from the billiard room with Fred Vincey, Mr. Fairbrother's thoughts about him had been rather gloomy. Playing at the Green Dragon once or oftener might have been a trifle in another man, but in Lydgate it was one of several signs that he was getting unlike his former self. He was beginning to do things for which he had formerly even an excessive scorn. Whatever certain dissatisfactions in marriage which some silly tinklings of gossip had given him hints of might have to do with this change, Mr. Fairbrother felt sure that it was chiefly connected with the debts which were being more and more distinctly reported, and he had begun to fear that any notion of Lydgate's having resources or friends in the background must be quite illusory. The rebuff he had met with in his first attempt to win Lydgate's confidence disinclined him to a second, but this news of the execution being actually in the house determined the vicar to overcome his reluctance. Lydgate had just dismissed a poor patient, in whom he was much interested, and he came forward to put out his hand with an open cheerfulness which surprised Mr. Fairbrother. Could this, too, be a proud rejection of sympathy and help? Never mind. The sympathy and help should be offered. "How are you, Lydgate? I came to see you because I had heard something which made me anxious about you," said the vicar, in the tone of a good brother, only that there was no reproach to it. They were both seated by this time, and Lydgate answered immediately. "I think I know what you mean. You had heard that there was an execution in the house?"
"Yes."
"Is it true?"
"It was true," said Lydgate, with an air of freedom, as if he did not mind talking about the affair now. "But the danger is over. The debt is paid. I am out of my difficulties now. I shall be freed from debts and able, I hope, to start afresh on a better plan."
"I am very thankful to hear it," said the vicar, folding back in his chair and speaking with that low-toned quickness which often follows the removal of a load. "I like that better than all the news and the Times. I confess I came to you with a heavy heart."
"Thank you for coming," said Lydgate cordially. "I can enjoy the kindness all the more because I'm happier. I have certainly been a good deal crushed. I'm afraid I shall find the bruises still painful by and by," he added, smiling rather sadly. "But just now I can only feel that the torture screw is off."
Mr. Fairbrother was silent for a moment and then said earnestly, "My dear fellow, let me ask you one question. Forgive me if I take a liberty."
"I don't believe you will ask anything that ought to offend me."
"Then, this is necessary to set my heart quite at rest. You have not, have you, in order to pay your debts, incurred another debt which may harass you worse hereafter?"
"No," said Lydgate, colouring slightly. "There is no reason why I should not tell you, since the fact is so, that the person to whom I am indebted is Bulstrode. He has made me a very handsome advance, £1,000, and he can afford to wait for repayment."
"Well, that is generous," said Mr. Fairbrother, compelling himself to approve of the man whom he disliked. His delicate feelings shrank from dwelling even in his thought on the fact that he had always urged Lydgate to avoid any personal entanglement with Bulstrode. He added immediately, "And Bulstrode must naturally feel an interest in your welfare, after you have worked with him in a way which has probably reduced your income instead of adding to it. I am glad to think that he has acted accordingly." Lydgate felt uncomfortable under these kindly suppositions. They made more distinct within him the uneasy consciousness which had shown its first dim stirrings only a few hours before, that Bulstrode's motives for his sudden beneficence, following close upon the chillest indifference, might be merely selfish. He let the kindly suppositions pass. He could not tell the history of the loan, but it was more vividly present with him than ever, as well as the fact which the vicar delicately ignored,
that this relation of personal indebtedness to Bulstrode was what he had once been most resolved to avoid. He began, instead of answering, to speak of his projected economies, and of his having come to look at his life from a different point of view. "I shall set up a surgery," he said. "I really think I made a mistaken effort in that respect, and if Rosamond will not mind, I shall take an apprentice. I don't like these things, but if one carries them out faithfully, they're not really lowering. I've had a severe galling to begin with. That will make the small rubs seem easy." Poor Lydgate, the "if Rosamond will not mind," which had fallen from him involuntarily as part of his thought, was a significant mark of the yoke he bore. But Mr. Fairbrother, whose hopes entered strongly into the same current with Lydgate's, and who knew nothing about him that could now raise a melancholy presentiment, left him with affectionate congratulation.
Chapter 71. 5 days after the death of Raffles, Mr. Bainbridge was standing at his leisure under the large archway leading into the yard of the Green Dragon. He was not fond of solitary contemplation, but he had only just come out of the house, and any human figure standing at ease under the archway in the early afternoon was as certain to attract companionship as a pigeon which has found something worth pecking at. In this case, there was no material object to feed upon, but the eye of reason saw a probability of mental sustenance in the form of gossip. Mr. Hopkins, the meek-mannered draper opposite, was the first to act on this inward vision, being the more ambitious of a little masculine talk because his customers were chiefly women. Mr. Bainbridge was rather curt to the draper, feeling that Hopkins was of course glad to talk to him, but that he was not going to waste much of his talk on Hopkins. Soon, however, there was a small cluster of more important listeners, who were either deposited from the passers-by or had sauntered to the spot expressly to see if there was anything going on at the Green Dragon. And Mr. Bainbridge was finding it worth his while to say many impressive things about the fine steps he had been seeing and the purchases he had made on a journey in the north from which he had just returned. Gentlemen present were assured that when they could show him anything to cut a blood mare, a bay rising four, which was to be seen at Doncaster if they chose to go and look at it, Mr. Bainbridge would gratify them by saying, would gratify them by being shot from here to Hereford. Also, a pair of blacks which he was going to put into the break recalled vividly to his mind a pair which he had sold to Faulkner in 19 for 100 guineas, and which Faulkner had sold for 160 2 months later. Any gent who could disprove this statement being offered the privilege of calling Mr. Bainbridge by a very ugly name until the exercise made his throat dry. When the discourse was at this point of animation, came up Mr. Frank Hawley. He was not a man to compromise his dignity by lounging at the Green Dragon, but happening to pass along the high street and seeing Bainbridge on the other side, he took some of his long strides across to ask the horse dealer whether he had found the first-rate gig horse which he'd engaged to look for. Mr. Hawley was requested to wait until he had seen a grey selected at Bilkley. If that did not meet his wishes to a hair, Bainbridge did not know a horse when he saw it, which seemed to be the highest conceivable unlikelihood. Mr. Hawley, standing with his back to the street, was fixing a time for looking at the grey and seeing it tried, when a horseman passed slowly by. "Bulstrode," said two or three voices at once in a low tone. One of them, which was the draper's, respectfully prefixing the Mr., but nobody having more intention in this interjectural naming than if they had said the Riverson coach, when that vehicle appeared in the distance. Mr. Hawley gave a careless glance round at Bulstrode's back, but as Bainbridge's eyes followed it, he made a sarcastic grimace. "By jingo, that reminds me," he began, lowering his voice a little. "I picked up something else at Bilkley besides your gig horse, Mr. Hawley. I picked up a fine story about Bulstrode. Do you know how he came by his fortune? Any gentleman wanting a bit of curious information, I can give it to him free of expense. If everybody got their deserts, Bulstrode might have to say his prayers at Botany Bay." "What do you mean?" said Mr. Hawley, thrusting his hands into his pockets and pushing a little forward under the archway. "If Bulstrode should turn out to be a rascal, Frank Hawley had a prophetic soul. I had it from a party who was an old chum of Bulstrode's. I'll tell you where I first picked it up," said Bainbridge, with a sudden gesture of his forefinger. "He was at Larcher's sale. But I knew nothing of him then. He slipped through my fingers. Was after Bulstrode, no doubt. He tells me he can tap Bulstrode to any amount, knows all his secrets.
However, he blabbed to me at Bilkley. He takes a stiff glass. Damn if I think he meant to turn kings into evidence, but he's that sort of bragging fellow. The bragging runs over hedge and ditch with him, till he'd brag of a spavin as if it'd fetch money. A man should know when to pull up. Mr. Bainbridge made this remark with an air of disgust, satisfied that his own bragging showed a fine sense of the marketable. "What's the man's name? Where can he be found?" said Mr. Hawley. "As to where he's been found, I left him to it at the Saracen's Head, but his name is Raffles." "Raffles!" exclaimed Mr. Hopkins. "I furnished his funeral yesterday. He was buried at Lowick. Mr. Bulstrode followed him. Very decent funeral." There was a strong sensation among the listeners. Mr. Bainbridge gave an ejaculation in which brimstone was the mildest word, and Mr. Hawley, knitting his brows and bending his head forward, exclaimed, "What? Where did the man die?" "At Stone Court," said the draper. "The housekeeper said he was a relation of the master's. He came there ill on Friday." "Why, it was on Wednesday I took a glass with him," interposed Bainbridge. "Did any doctor attend him?" said Mr. Hawley. "Yes, Mr. Lydgate. Mr. Bulstrode sat up with him one night. He died the third morning." "Go on, Bainbridge," said Mr. Hawley insistently. "What did this fellow say about Bulstrode?" The group had already become larger, the town clerk's presence being a guarantee that something worth listening to was going on there, and Mr. Bainbridge delivered his narrative in the hearing of seven. It was mainly what we know, including the fact about Will Ladislaw, with some local color and circumstance added. It was what Bulstrode had dreaded the betrayal of, and hoped to have buried forever with the corpse of Raffles. It was that haunting ghost of his earlier life, which, as he rode past the archway of the Green Dragon, he was trusting that Providence had delivered him from. Yes, Providence. He had not confessed to himself yet that he had done anything in the way of contrivance to this end. He had accepted what seemed to have been offered. It was impossible to prove that he had done anything which hastened the departure of that man's soul. But the gossip about Bulstrode spread through Middlemarch like the smell of fire. Mr. Frank Hawley followed up his information by sending a clerk whom he could trust to Stone Court on a pretext of inquiring about Hay, but really to gather all that he could be learned about Raffles and his illness from Mrs. Abel. In this way it came to his knowledge that Mr. Garth had carried the man to Stone Court in his gig, and Mr. Hawley in consequence took an opportunity of seeing Caleb, calling at his office to ask whether he had time to undertake an arbitration if it were required, and then asking him incidentally about Raffles. Caleb was betrayed into no word injurious to Bulstrode beyond the fact which he was forced to admit that he had given up acting for him within the last week. Mr. Hawley drew his inferences, and feeling convinced that Raffles had told his story to Garth, and that Garth had given up Bulstrode's affairs in consequence, said so a few hours later to Mr. Toller. The statement was passed on until it had quite lost the stamp of an inference, and was taken as information coming straight from Garth, so that even a diligent historian might have concluded Caleb to be the chief publisher of Bulstrode's misdemeanors. Mr. Hawley was not slow to perceive that there was no handle for the law, either in the revelations made by Raffles or in the circumstances of his death. He had himself ridden to Lowick Village, that he might look at the register and talk over the whole matter with Mr. Fairbrother, who was not more surprised than the lawyer that an ugly secret should have come to light about Bulstrode, though he had always had justice enough in him to hinder his antipathy from turning into conclusions. But while they were talking about another combination was silently going forward in Mr. Fairbrother's mind, which foreshadowed what was soon to be loudly spoken of in Middlemarch as a necessary putting of two and two together. With the reasons which kept Bulstrode in dread of Raffles, there flashed the thought that the dread might have something to do with his munificence towards his medical man, and though he resisted the suggestion that it had been consciously accepted in any way as a bribe, he had a foreboding that this complication of things might be of malignant effect on Lydgate's reputation. He perceived that Mr. Hawley knew nothing at present of the sudden relief from debt, and he himself was careful to glide away from all approaches towards the subject. "Well," he said with a deep breath, wanting to wind up the illimitable discussion of what might have been, though nothing could be legally proven, "it is a strange story. So our mercurial Ladislaw has a queer genealogy. A high-spirited young lady and a musical Polish patriot made a likely enough stock for him to spring from, but I should never have suspected a grafting of the Jew pawnbroker. However, there's no knowing what a mixture will turn out beforehand. Some sorts of dirt serve to clarify.
It's just what I should have expected, said Mr. Hawley, mounting his horse. Any cursed alien blood, Jew, Corsican, or gypsy. I know he's one of your black sheep, Hawley, but he is a really disinterested, unworldly fellow, said Mr. Fairbrother, smiling.
Aye, that is your Whiggish twist, said Mr. Hawley, who had been in the habit of saying apologetically that Fairbrother was such a damned pleasant, good-hearted fellow, you would mistake him for a Tory.
Mr. Hawley rode home without thinking of Lydgate's attendance on Raffles in any other light than as a piece of evidence on the side of Bulstrode. But the news that Lydgate had all at once become able not only to get rid of the execution in his house, but to pay all his debts in Middlemarch was spreading fast. Gathering round it conjectures and comments which gave it new body and impetus, and soon filling the ears of other persons besides Mr. Hawley, who were not slow to see a significant relation between this sudden command of money and Bulstrode's desire to stifle the scandal of Raffles. That the money came from Bulstrode would infallibly have been guessed, even if there had been no direct evidence of it. For he had beforehand entered into the gossip about Lydgate's affairs, and neither his father-in-law nor his own family would do anything for him. And direct evidence was furnished, not only by a clerk at the bank, but by innocent Mrs. Bulstrode herself, who mentioned the loan to Mrs. Plimdale, who mentioned it to her daughter-in-law of the House of Toller, who mentioned it generally. The business was felt to be so public and important that it required dinners to feed it, and many invitations were just then issued and accepted on the strength of the scandal concerning Bulstrode and Lydgate. Wives, widows, and single ladies took their work and went out to tea oftener than usual, and whole public conviviality from the Green Dragon to Dollops gathered a zest which could not be won from the question whether the Lords would throw out the Reform Bill. For hardly anybody doubted that same scandalous reason or other was at the bottom of Bulstrode's liberality to Lydgate. Mr. Hawley, indeed, in the first instance, invited a select party, including the two physicians, with Mr. Toller and Mr. Wrench, expressly to hold a close discussion as to the probabilities of Raffles' illness, reciting to them all the particulars which had been gathered from Mrs. Abel in connection with Lydgate's certificate, that the death was due to delirium tremens. And the medical gentlemen, who all stood undisturbedly on the old paths in relation to this disease, declared that they could see nothing in these particulars which could be transformed into a positive ground of suspicion. But the moral grounds of suspicion remained. The strong motives Bulstrode clearly had for wishing to be rid of Raffles, and the fact that at this critical moment he had given Lydgate the help which he must for some time have known the need for. The disposition, moreover, to believe that Bulstrode would be unscrupulous, and the absence of any indisposition to believe that Lydgate might be as easily bribed as other haughty-minded men when they found themselves in want of money. Even if the money had been given merely to make him hold his tongue about the scandal of Bulstrode's earlier life, the fact threw an odious light on Lydgate, who had long been sneered at as making himself subservient to the banker for the sake of working himself into predominance, and discrediting the elder members of his profession. Hence, in spite of the negative as to any direct sign of guilt in relation to the death at Stone Court, Mr. Hawley's select party broke up with the sense that the affair had an ugly look. But this vague conviction of indeterminable guilt, which was enough to keep up much head-shaking and biting innuendo, even among substantial professional seniors, had for the general mind all the superior power of mystery over fact. Everybody liked better to conjecture how the thing was than simply to know it, for conjecture soon became more confident than knowledge, and had a more liberal allowance for the incompatible. Even the more definite scandal concerning Bulstrode's earlier life was, for some minds, melted into the mass of mystery, as so much lively metal to be poured out in dialogue, and to take such fantastic shapes as heaven pleased. This was the tone of thought chiefly sanctioned by Mrs. Dollop, the spirited landlady of the Tankard in Slaughter Lane, who had often to resist the shallow pragmatism of customers disposed to think that their reports from the outer world were of equal force with what had come up in her mind. How it had been brought to her, she didn't know, but it was there before her as if it had been scored with the chalk on the chimney board, as Bulstrode should say. His inside was that black, as if the hairs of his head knowed the thoughts of his heart, he'd tear 'em up by the roots. "That's odd," said Mr. Limp, a meditative shoemaker with weak eyes and a piping voice. "Why, I read in the Trumpet that was what the Duke of Wellington said when he turned his coat and went over to the Romans." "Very like," said Mrs. Dollop. "If one rascal said it, it's more reason why another should. But hypocrite as he's been, and holding things with that high hand, as there was no parson in the country good enough for him, he was forced to take old Harry into his counsel, and old Harry's been too many for him."
"Aye, aye, he's accomplished he can't send out of the country," said Mr. Crabb, the glazier, who gathered much news and groped among it dimly. "But by what I can make out, there's them says Bulstrode was for running away, for fear of being found out, before now."
"He'll be drove away, whether or no," said Mr. Dill, the barber, who had just dropped in. "I shaved Fletcher, Holly's clerk, this morning. He's got a bad finger. And he says they're all of one mind to get rid of Bulstrode. Mr. Thesiger's turned against him and wants him out of the parish. And there's gentlemen in this town says they'd as soon dine with a fellow from the hulks. And a deal sooner I would," says Fletcher. "For what's more against one's stomach than a man coming and making himself bad company with his religion, and giving out as the Ten Commandments are not enough for him, and all the while he's worse than half the men at the treadmill? Fletcher said so himself."
"It'll be a bad thing for the town, though, if Bulstrode's money goes out of it," said Mr. Limp, quaveringly.
"Ah, there's better folks spend their money worse," said a firm-voiced dyer, whose crimson hands looked out of keeping with his good-natured face.
"But he won't keep his money, but what I can make out," said the glazier. "Don't they say as there's somebody can strip it off him?"
"By what I can understand, they could take every penny off him if they went a-lawing."
"No such thing," said the barber, who felt himself a little above his company at Dollop's, but liked it none the worse. "Fletcher says it's no such thing. He says they might prove, over and over again, whose child this young Ladislaw was, and they do no more than if they proved I came out of the fens. He couldn't touch a penny."
"Look you there, now," said Mrs. Dollop indignantly. "I thank the Lord he took my children to himself, if that's all the law can do for the motherless. And by that, it's of no use who your father and mother is. But as to listening to what one lawyer says without asking another, I wonder at a man of your cleverness, Mr. Dill. It's well known there's always two sides, if no more. Else who'd go to law, I should like to know? It's a poor tale, with all the law as there is up and down, if it's no use proving whose child you are. Fletcher may say that if he likes, but I don't. Don't Fletcher me."
Mr. Dill affected to laugh in a complimentary way at Mrs. Dollop, as a woman who was more than a match for the lawyers, being disposed to submit to much twitting from a landlady who had a long score against him. "If they come to lawing, and it's all true as folks say, there's more to be looked to nor money," said the glazier. "There's this poor creature as is dead and gone. By what I can make out, he'd seen the day when he was a deal finer gentleman nor Bulstrode."
"Finer gentleman, I'll warrant him," said Mrs. Dollop, "and a far personable man, by what I can hear. As I said when Mr. Baldwin, the tax-gatherer, comes in, a-standin' where you sit, and says, 'Bulstrode got all his money as he brought into this town by thievin' and swindlin',' I said, 'You don't make me no wiser, Mr. Baldwin. It set my blood a-creepin' to look at him ever since here he came into Slaughter Lane a-wantin' to buy the house over my head. Folks don't look the colour of the dough-tub and stare at you as if they wanted to see into your backbone for nothing.' That was what I said, and Mr. Baldwin can bear me witness."
"And in the rights of it, too," said Mr. Crabb. "For by what I can make out, this Raffles, as they call him, was a lusty, fresh-coloured man as you'd wish to see, and the best of company. Though dead he lies in Lowick churchyard, sure enough, and by what I can understand, there's them knows more than they should know about how he got there."
"I'll believe you," said Mrs. Dollop, with a touch of scorn at Mr. Crabb's apparent dimness. "When a man's been ticed to a lone house, and there's them can pay for hospitals and nurses for half the countryside, choose to be sitters up night and day, and nobody to come near but a doctor as is known to stick at nothing, and as poor as he can hang together, and after that so flush of money as he can pay off Mr. Biles the butcher as his bill has been running on for the best of joints since last Michaelmas was a 12-month, I don't want anybody to come and tell me as there's been more going on nor the prayer book's got a service for. I don't want to stand winking and blinking and thinking."
Mrs. Dollop looked round with the air of a landlady accustomed to dominate her company. There was a chorus of adhesion from the more courageous, but Mr. Limp, after taking a draught, placed his flat hands together and pressed them hard between his knees, looking down at them with blear-eyed contemplation, as if the scorching power of Mrs. Dollop's speech had quite dried up and nullified his wits, until they could be brought round again by further moisture.
"Why shouldn't they dig the man up and have the crowner?" said the dyer. "It's been done many and many's the time. If there's been foul play, they might find it out." "Not they, Mr. Jonas," said Mrs. Dollop emphatically. "I know what doctors are. They are a deal too cunning to be found out. And this Dr. Lydgate that's been for cutting up everybody before the breath was well out of their body, it's plain enough what use he wanted to make a looking into respectable people's insides. He knows drugs, you may be sure, as you can neither smell nor see, neither before they're swallowed nor after. Why, I've seen drops myself ordered by Dr. Gambit, as is our club doctor and a good character, and he's brought more live children into the world nor ever another in Middlemarch. I say I seen drop myself has made no difference whether they was in the glass or out, and yet have griped you the next day. So I'll leave your own sense to judge. Don't tell me. All I say is, it's a mercy they didn't take this Dr. Lydgate onto our club. There's many a mother's child might have rued it." The heads of this discussion at Dollop's had been the common theme among all classes in the town, had been carried to Lowick Parsonage on one side and to Tipton Grange on the other, had come fully to the ears of the Vincey family, and had been discussed with sad reference to poor Harriet by all Mrs. Bulstrode's friends before Lydgate knew distinctly why people were looking strangely at him, and before Bulstrode himself suspected the betrayal of his secrets. He had not been accustomed to very cordial relations with his neighbors, and hence he could not miss the signs of cordiality. Moreover, he had been taking journeys on business of various kinds, having now made up his mind that he need not quit Middlemarch, and feeling able consequently to determine on matters which he had before left in suspense. "We will make a journey to Chendelham in the course of a month or two," he had said to his wife. "There are great spiritual advantages to be had in that town along with the air and the waters, and 6 weeks there will be eminently refreshing to us." He really believed in the spiritual advantages, and meant that his life henceforth should be the more devoted because of those later sins which he represented to himself as hypothetic, praying hypothetically for his pardon, if I have herein transgressed. As to the hospital, he avoided saying anything further to Lydgate, fearing to manifest a too sudden change of plans immediately on the death of Raffles. In his secret soul, he believed that Lydgate suspected his orders to have been intentionally disobeyed, and suspecting this, he might also suspect a motive. But nothing had been betrayed to him as to the history of Raffles, and Bulstrode was anxious not to do anything which would give emphasis to his undefined suspicions. As to any certainty that a particular method of treatment would either save or kill, Lydgate himself was constantly arguing against such dogmatism. He had no right to speak, and he had every motive for being silent. Hence, Bulstrode felt himself providentially secured. The only incident he had strongly winced under had been an occasional encounter with Caleb Garth, who, however, had raised his hat with mild gravity. Meanwhile, on the part of the principal townsmen, a strong determination was growing against him. A meeting was to be held in the town hall on a sanitary question which had risen into pressing importance by the occurrence of a cholera case in the town. Since the Act of Parliament, which had been hurriedly passed, authorizing assessments for sanitary measures, there had been a board for the superintendence of such measures appointed in Middlemarch, and much cleansing and preparation had been concurred in by Whigs and Tories. The question now was whether a piece of ground outside the town should be secured as a burial ground by means of assessment or by private subscription. The meeting was to be open, and almost everybody of importance in the town was expected to be there. Mr. Bulstrode was a member of the board, and just before 12 o'clock he started from the bank with the intention of urging the plan of private subscription. Under the hesitation of his projects, he had for some time kept himself in the background, and he felt that he should this morning resume his old position as a man of action and influence in the public affairs of the town, where he expected to end his days. Among the various persons going in the same direction, he saw Lydgate. They joined, talked over the object of the meeting, and entered it together. It seemed that everybody of mark had been earlier than they, but there were still spaces left near the head of the large central table, and they made their way thither. Mr. Fairbrother sat opposite, not far from Mr. Hawley. All the medical men were there. Mr. Thesiger was in the chair, and Mr. Brooke of Tipton was on his right hand. Lydgate noticed a peculiar interchange of glances when he and Bulstrode took their seats. After the business had been fully opened by the chairman, who pointed out the advantages of purchasing by subscription a piece of ground large enough to be ultimately used as a general cemetery, Mr. Bulstrode, whose rather high-pitched but subdued and fluent voice the town was used to at meetings of this sort, rose and asked leave to deliver his opinion. Lydgate could see again the peculiar interchange of glances before Mr. Hawley started up and said in his firm, resonant voice, Mr. Chairman, I request that before anyone delivers his opinion on this point, I may be permitted to speak on a question of public feeling, which not only by myself, but by many gentlemen present, is regarded as preliminary. Mr. Hawley's mode of speech, even when public decorum repressed his awful language, was formidable in its curtness and self-possession. Mr. Thesiger sanctioned the request. Mr. Bulstrode sat down, and Mr. Hawley continued. In what I have to say, Mr. Chairman, I'm not speaking simply on my own behalf. I'm speaking with the concurrence and at the express request of no fewer than 8 of my fellow townsmen, who are immediately around us. It is our united sentiment that Mr. Bulstrode should be called upon, and I do now call upon him, to resign public positions which he holds not simply as a taxpayer, but as a gentleman among gentlemen. There are practices and there are acts which, owing to circumstances, the law cannot visit, though they may be worse than many things which are legally punishable. Honest men and gentlemen, if they don't want the company of people who perpetrate such acts, have got to defend themselves as they best can, and that is what I and the friends whom I may call my clients in this affair are determined to do. I don't say that Mr. Bulstrode has been guilty of shameful acts, but I call upon him either publicly to deny and confute the scandalous statements made against him by a man now dead and who died in his house, the statement that he was for many years engaged in nefarious practices and that he won his fortune by dishonest procedures, or else to withdraw from positions which could only have been allowed him as a gentleman among gentlemen. All eyes in the room were turned on Mr. Bulstrode, who, since the first mention of his name, had been going through a crisis of feeling almost too violent for his delicate frame to support. Lydgate, who himself was undergoing a shock as from the terrible practical interpretation of some faint augury, felt nevertheless that his own movement of resentful hatred was checked by that instinct of the healer which thinks first of bringing rescue or relief to the sufferer, when he looked at the shrunken misery of Bulstrode's livid face. The quick vision that his life was after all a failure, that he was a dishonored man and must quail before the glance of those towards whom he had habitually assumed the attitude of a reprover, that God had disowned him before men and left him unscreened to the triumphant scorn of those who were glad to have their hatred justified, the sense of utter futility and that equivocation with his conscience in dealing with the life of his accomplice, an equivocation which now turned venomously upon him with the full-grown fang of a discovered lie. All this rushed through him like the agony of terror which fails to kill, and leaves the ears still open to the returning wave of execration. The sudden sense of exposure after the re-established sense of safety came, not to the coarse organization of a criminal, but to the susceptible nerve of a man whose intensest being lay in such mastery and predominance as the conditions of his life had shaped for him. But in that intense being lay the strength of reaction. Through all his bodily infirmity, there ran a tenacious nerve of ambitious self-preserving will, which had continually leaped out like a flame, scattering all doctrinal fears, and which, even while he sat an object of compassion for the merciful, was beginning to stir and glow under his ashy paleness. Before the last words were out of Mr. Hawley's mouth, Bulstrode felt that he should answer, and that his answer would be a retort. He dared not get up and say, "I am not guilty. The whole story is false." Even if he had dared this, it would have seemed to him, under his present keen sense of betrayal, as vain as to pull, for covering to his nakedness, a frail rag which would rend at every last strain. For a few moments there was total silence, while every man in the room was looking at Bulstrode. He sat perfectly still, leaning hard against the back of his chair. He could not venture to rise, and when he began to speak, he pressed his hands upon the seat of each side of him. But his voice was perfectly audible, though hoarser than usual, and his words were distinctly pronounced, though he paused between sentences, as if short of breath. He said, turning first round toward Mr. Thesiger, and then looking at Mr. Hawley, "I protest before you, sir, as a Christian minister, against the sanction of proceedings towards me which are dictated by virulent hatred. Those who were hostile to me are glad to believe any libel uttered by a loose tongue against me, and their consciences become strict against me. Say that the evil speaking of which I am to be made the victim accuses me of malpractices." Here, Bulstrode's voice rose and took on a more biting accent till it seemed a low cry. "Who shall be my accuser?" Not men whose own lives are unchristian, nay, scandalous. Not men who themselves use low instruments to carry out their ends, whose profession is a tissue of chicanery, who have been spending their income on their own sensual enjoyments, while I've been devoting mine to advance the best objects with regard to this life and the next. After the word chicanery, there was a growing noise, half of murmurs and half of hisses, while four persons started up at once, Mr. Hawley, Mr. Toller, Mr. Chichely, and Mr. Hackbutt. But Mr. Hawley's outburst was instantaneous, and left the others in silence. If you mean me, sir, I call you and everyone else to the inspection of my professional life. As to Christian or unchristian, I repudiate your canting, palavering Christianity. And as to the way in which I spend my income, it is not my principle to maintain thieves and cheat offspring of their due inheritance in order to support religion and set myself up as a saintly killjoy. I affect no niceness of conscience. I have not found any nice standards necessary yet to measure your actions by, sir, and I again call upon you to enter into satisfactory explanations concerning the scandals against you, or else to withdraw from posts in which we at any rate decline you as a colleague. I say, sir, we decline to cooperate with a man whose character is not cleared from infamous lights cast upon it, not only by reports, but by recent actions.
Allow me, Mr. Hawley, said the chairman, and Mr. Hawley, still fuming, bowed half impatiently and sat down with his hands thrust deep in his pockets.
Mr. Bulstrode, it is not desirable, I think, to prolong the present discussion, said Mr. Thesiger, turning to the pallid, trembling man. I must so far concur with what has fallen from Mr. Hawley in expression of a general feeling as to think it due to your Christian profession that you should clear yourself, if possible, from unhappy aspersions. I, for my part, should be willing to give you full opportunity in hearing, but I must say that your present attitude is painfully inconsistent with those principles which you have sought to identify yourself with, and for the honor of which I am bound to care. I recommend you at present, as your clergyman and one who hopes for your reinstatement in respect, to quit the room and avoid further hindrance to business.
Bulstrode, after a moment's hesitation, took his hat from the floor and slowly rose, but he grasped the corner of his chair so totteringly that Lydgate felt sure there was not strength enough in him to walk away without support. What could he do? He could not see a man sink close to him for want of help. He rose and gave his arm to Bulstrode, and in that way led him out of the room. Yet this act, which might have been one of gentle duty and pure compassion, was at this moment unspeakably bitter to him. It seemed as if he were putting his sign manual to that association of himself with Bulstrode, of which he now saw the full meaning as it must have presented itself to other minds. He now felt that the conviction that this man who was leaning tremblingly on his arm had given him the £1,000 as a bribe, and that somehow the treatment of Raffles had been tampered with from an evil motive. The inferences were closely linked enough. The town knew of the loan, believed it to be a bribe, and believed that he took it as a bribe. Poor Lydgate, his mind struggling under the terrible clutch of this revelation, was all the while morally forced to take Mr. Bulstrode to the bank, send a man off for his carriage, and wait to accompany him home. Meanwhile, the business of the meeting was dispatched and fringed off into eager discussion among various groups concerning this affair of Bulstrode and Lydgate. Mr. Brooke, who had before heard only imperfect hints of it, and was very uneasy that he had gone a little too far in countenancing Bulstrode, now got himself fully informed, and felt some benevolent sadness in talking to Mr. Fairbrother about the ugly light in which Lydgate had come to be regarded. Mr. Fairbrother was going to walk back to Lowick. "Step into my carriage," said Mr. Brooke. "I'm going round to see Mrs. Casaubon. She was to come back from Yorkshire last night. She would like to see me, you know." So they drove along, Mr. Brooke chatting with good-natured hope that there had not really been anything black in Lydgate's behavior, a young fellow whom he had seen to be quite above the common mark, when he brought a letter from his uncle Sir Godwin. Mr. Fairbrother said little. He was deeply mournful. With a keen perception of human weakness, he could not be confident that under the pressure of humiliating needs, Lydgate had not fallen below himself. When the carriage drove up to the gate of the manor, Dorothea was out on the gravel and came to greet them.
"Well, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, "we've just come from a meeting, a sanitary meeting, you know."
"Was Mr. Lydgate there?" said Dorothea, who looked full of health and animation, and stood with her head bare under the gleaming April lights. "I want to see him and have a great consultation with him about the hospital.
I have engaged with Mr. Bulstrode to do so.
Oh, my dear, said Mr. Brooke, we've been hearing bad news. Bad news, you know.
They walked through the garden towards the churchyard gate, Mr. Fairbrother wanting to go on to the parsonage, and Dorothea heard the whole sad story. She listened with deep interest and begged to hear twice over the facts and impressions concerning Lydgate. After a short silence, pausing at the churchyard gate and addressing Mr. Fairbrother, she said energetically, "You don't believe that Mr. Lydgate is guilty of anything base? I will not believe it. Let us find out the truth and clear him."
Book 8, Sunset and Sunrise, Chapter 72. Dorothea's impetuous generosity, which would have leaped at once to the vindication of Lydgate from the suspicion of having accepted money as a bribe, underwent a melancholy check when she came to consider all the circumstances of the case by the light of Mr. Fairbrother's experience.
"It is a delicate matter to touch," she said. "How can we begin to inquire into it? It must be either publicly by setting the magistrate and coroner to work, or privately by questioning Lydgate. As to the first proceeding, there's no solid ground to go upon, else Holly would have adopted it. And as to opening the subject with Lydgate, I confess I should shrink from it. He would probably take it as a deadly insult. I have more than once experienced the difficulty of speaking to him on personal matters, and one should know the truth about his conduct beforehand to feel very confident of a good result."
"I feel convinced that his conduct has not been guilty. I believe that people are almost always better than their neighbors think they are," said Dorothea. Some of her intensest experience in the last 2 years had set her mind strongly in opposition to any unfavorable construction of others, and for the first time she felt rather discontented with Mr. Fairbrother. She disliked this cautious weighing of consequences, instead of an ardent faith in efforts of justice and mercy, which would conquer by their emotional force. 2 days afterwards, he was dining at the manor with her uncle and the Chethams, and when the dessert was standing uneaten, the servants were out of the room, and Mr. Brooke was nodding in a nap. She returned to the subject with renewed vivacity. "Mr. Lydgate would understand that if his friends hear a calumny about him, their first wish must be to justify him. What do we live for, if it is not to make life less difficult to each other? I cannot be indifferent to the troubles of a man who advised me in my trouble, and attended me in my illness." Dorothea's tone and manner were not more energetic than they had been when she was at the head of her uncle's table nearly 3 years before, and her experience since had given her more right to express a decided opinion. But Sir James Chetham was no longer the diffident and acquiescent suitor. He was the anxious brother-in-law, with a devout admiration for his sister, but with a constant alarm lest she should fall under some new illusion almost as bad as marrying Casaubon. He smiled much less. When he said exactly, it was more often an introduction to a dissentient opinion than in those submissive bachelor days, and Dorothea found to her surprise that she had to resolve not to be afraid of him, all the more because he was really her best friend. He disagreed with her now.
"But Dorothea," he said remonstrantly, "you can't undertake to manage a man's life for him in that way. Lydgate must know, at least he will soon come to know how he stands. If he can clear himself, he will. He must act for himself."
"I think his friends must wait till they find an opportunity," added Mr. Fairbrother. "It is possible. I have often felt so much weakness in myself that I can conceive even a man of honorable disposition, such as I have always believed Lydgate to be, succumbing to such a temptation as that of accepting money which was offered more or less indirectly as a bribe to ensure his silence about scandalous facts long gone by. I say, I can conceive this, if he were under the pressure of hard circumstances, if he had been harassed as I feel sure Lydgate has been. I would not believe anything worse of him except under stringent proof, but there is the terrible nemesis following on some errors, that it is always possible for those who like it to interpret them into a crime. There is no proof in favor of the man outside his own consciousness and assertion." "Oh, how cruel," said Dorothea, clasping her hands. "And would you not like to be the one person who believed in that man's innocence if the rest of the world belied him? Besides, there's a man's character beforehand to speak for him."
"But, my dear Mrs. Casaubon," said Mr. Fairbrother, smiling gently at her ardor, "character is not cut in marble. It is not something solid and unalterable. It is something living and changing, and may become diseased as our bodies do."
"Then it may be rescued and healed," said Dorothea. "I should not be afraid of asking Mr. Lydgate to tell me the truth, that I might help him. Why should I be afraid? Now that I'm not to have the land, James, I might do as Mr. Bulstrode proposed, and take his place in providing for the hospital. And if I have to consult Mr. Lydgate, to know thoroughly what are the prospects of doing good by keeping up the present plans, there is the best opportunity in the world for me to ask for his confidence, and he would be able to tell me things which might make all the circumstances clear. Then we would all stand by him and bring him out of his trouble. People glorify all sorts of bravery, except the bravery they might show on behalf of their nearest neighbors." Dorothea's eyes had a moist brightness in them, and the changed tones of her voice roused her uncle, who began to listen. "It is true that a woman may venture on some efforts of sympathy which would hardly succeed if we men undertook them," said Mr. Fairbrother, almost converted by Dorothea's ardor. "Surely a woman is bound to be cautious and listen to those who know the world better than she does," said Sir James, with his little frown. "Whatever you do in the end, Dorothea, you should really keep back at present, and not volunteer any meddling with this Bulstrode business. We don't know yet what may turn up. You must agree with me?" he ended, looking at Mr. Fairbrother. "I do think it would be better to wait," said the latter. "Yes, yes, my dear," said Mr. Brooke, not quite knowing at what point the discussion had arrived, but coming up to it with a contribution which was generally appropriate. "It is easy to go too far, you know. You must not let your ideas run away with you. And as to being in a hurry to put money into schemes, it won't do, you know. Garth has drawn me in uncommonly with repairs, draining, that sort of thing. I'm uncommonly out of pocket with one thing or another. I must pull up. As for you, Chetham, you were spending a fortune on those oak fences round your demesnes." Dorothea, submitting uneasily to this discouragement, went with Celia into the library, which was her usual drawing-room. "Now, Dodo, do listen to what James says," said Celia, "else you'll be getting into a scrape. You always did, and you always will, when you set about doing as you please. And I think it is a mercy now, after all, that you've got James to think for you. He lets you have your plan, only he hinders you from being taken in. And that is the good of having a brother instead of a husband. A husband would not let you have your plans." "As if I wanted a husband," said Dorothea. "I only want not to have my feelings checked at every turn." Mrs. Casaubon was still undisciplined enough to burst into angry tears. "No, really, Dodo," said Celia, with rather a deeper guttural than usual, "you are contradictory. First one thing and then another. You used to submit to Mr. Casaubon quite shamefully. I think you would have given up ever coming to see me if he had asked you." "Of course I submitted to him, because it was my duty, it was my feeling for him," said Dorothea, looking through the prism of her tears. "Then why can't you think it your duty to submit a little to what James wishes?" said Celia, with a sense of stringency in her argument. "Because he only wishes what is for your own good. And of course, men know best about everything, except what women know better." Dorothea laughed and forgot her tears. "Well, I mean about babies and those things," explained Celia. "I should not give up to James when I knew he was wrong, as you used to do to Mr. Casaubon."